I am nature, and so are you. My bones are strong because I ate broccoli grown hundreds of miles away from where I lived as a child. A migrant farmer dusted the plant with chemicals to prevent pests and later harvested it for poverty wages that she earned in unfavorable working conditions. My muscles are strong because I ate quinoa grown in Bolivia by a farmer whose family cannot afford to eat this, their traditional crop, because it's too expensive for them to purchase now that it's exported to the global north for a much higher price, and his wages have not seen an appropriate increase. The blood that runs through my veins was once the water that fell as rain on the forest and drained into the protected water area near our home. But I am very fortunate now, because this water is relatively clean. The water I drank where I lived in Indiana came from a river that was illegally used to dump factory farm sewage and contained nitrogen fertilizer, herbicides, and pesticides that ran off the many farms along the banks of the river. The air that has passed through my lungs sometimes carries car, truck, and train exhaust, and it is not as clear as the air that I once enjoyed in Western Illinois, where the people were fewer and farther between. The dawn chorus of birdsong that once greeted my ears each morning as a child growing up in Ohio filled me with life and energy for a new day. But we know now that there are fewer voices in that choir, less vitality, less energy. I love nature because I am nature. If I don't work to protect the earth, then I don't protect myself, and I don't protect you. I am nature, and I'm enraged by this, like the superstorms that are disrupting our communities. I am nature, and I am angered as I see myself exploited, raped, and burned for the profit of less than 100 uber-wealthy people who are allowed to proceed unchecked by our ever-weakening democracies. I am nature, and I am grieved by the mass extinction of the animal kingdom, which once thrived but is now wavering because of ecosystem collapse and out-of-control development of the wilds. I am nature, and I am concerned that there will soon be more plastic than fish in the ocean. I am nature, and I'm deeply grieved that children and young people today have to worry about their future, afraid that the earth will become too degraded and warmed to support life. As environmentalist Annie Leonard said, there is no away. When we throw anything away, it must go somewhere. If we consider the precious interdependent web of life of which we are a part, and honestly accept that there is no away, that our actions always create ripples on the threads of the web, causing every strand to vibrate, then we can understand ourselves and our actions as always impacting the whole. The scenarios I shared above are meant to illustrate how my choices and the choices of others are entangled in complex textures. Just like there is no way, our choices are not just an individual event impacting our own self-interests. Rather, our choices are offered to us on a menu that's been created by the collective choices that others have made in the past. And our actions inform the menu of choices that will be available to others in the future. I realize that owning that everything we do has an impact might seem like an overwhelming amount of responsibility, and perhaps more responsibility than we feel ready to accept. But if we look at it another way, there is hope in seeing that each choice that we make can lead to a positive difference, a ripple of love across the interdependent web of life. As I said before, I love nature because I am nature. If I don't work to protect the earth, then I don't protect myself, and I don't protect you. As I see it, if I love myself, and if I love you, I have no choice but to engage in environmental justice work. In closing, I will share two questions that reside in my heart and mind as I engage with work with the Green Team, attend Sunrise Movement Hub meetings here at the church, or march in climate strikes and actions. The first, do we love ourselves enough to make the radical changes we must make and make soon? And two, will a sufficient number of people choose to send positive and loving vibrations across the interdependent web of life in time to avert the unthinkable?
I sat at my daughter's fifth grade chorus concert feeling confused. On stage were kids of every possible skin tone, standing relaxed and comfortable side by side. Parents around me were being supportive. I saw everything that I was attracted to about Randolph, but I didn't feel a part of it. The white families that had been so easy to talk to had by this point fulfilled their intentions of moving their kids out of Randolph schools before middle school. And my list of people who I had a good relationship with despite racial difference was, after all these years, depressingly short. I glanced again to the stage and was overcome by a disorienting feeling of otherness. This past year, I dove into costume production for her middle school play, Hairspray, a play that openly confronts racism. Conversations involved things like asking a kid with a tan skin tone whether she was cast as one of the black characters or one of the white ones, and informing kids that they had to choose from specific piles of clothes based on their race. The pain inherent in these remarks was in my face in a way that had never been before. I listened to the conversations of the carload of kids I would drive home after practice. I hadn't realized how much race had been an elephant in the room for me until I was surrounded by these kids who had no qualms about exposing and discussing that elephant. And I hadn't realized how much race had colored my expectations until I was repeatedly humbled by the talent, grit, and resourcefulness of those kids in my back seat. The hard work of recalibration in my brain was impossible to ignore. Having listened all winter to this carload of kids singing Hairspray songs over and over, I sat down to opening night anticipating no surprises. So when the character of Seaweed stepped to the front of the stage to sing the first line of his big song, I can't see why people look at me and only see the color of my face. I was shocked to find that I couldn't breathe. Snapshot after snapshot flickered through my brain. I saw all the conversations I had had with those white families in Randolph as they prepared their move out. Their gaze had bounced off the colored faces in front of us like they were mirrors and had immediately turned to focus somewhere else. I remembered time after time that friends and family had said to me, "Are you really planning to stay in Randolph?" Confident in their ability to judge from a distance. I'd never offered up any compelling reason to take a second look. I heard CB's voice from the workshop here on transgender rights, saying, "Why is the focus on me so narrow? Why does nobody ask what drives me? What are my passions? Aren't these the more important questions and the more interesting ones?" And I recognized the shallow angle from which I had approached my conversations with the black people I encountered. This person has every reason to distrust me. This person may even be angry with me. I have no idea really what this person's life is like. I'm likely to say something stupid. Tread carefully. The question, "What are you interested in?" That had never been even close to anything I had thought to ask. I can't see why people look at me and only see the color of my face. I knew this boy who was playing Seaweed. I knew he had everything to look at. And I knew he set off fireworks to be seen. I had come to care about him deeply. He's so similar in real life to the character he was playing that the distinction blurred. And I saw him as himself, standing tall, focused direct, charging me and huge swaths of my white world with not seeing him beyond the color of his face. And the look of heartbreak and horror I felt appear on my face was not what I wanted to say to him. But Hairspray is not a play about despair. It is a play about hope and action and singing and dancing, and there were still kids on that stage. And those kids had talent, they had passion, they were letting loose. They swept me up again until over the tumult in my brain, I heard the line, "The Corny Collins Show is now officially integrated." And the crowd of parents around me went crazy. Everything changed for me in Randolph that night. At the request to look beyond, I was finally able to see the people in front of me. And at that moment of shared emotional release and pride in our children, the community I had watched from the outside became my community.
Good morning, my name is Linda. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about my experience in Tucson, Arizona, where I was volunteering as an outreach volunteer for No More Deaths, a humanitarian aid organization which seeks to essentially end the suffering in the southern deserts that's caused by U.S. policies there. I'm on the bill of fare today as somebody speaking about immigration. It's very hard to speak about the entire swath of immigration problems that we have in the United States and, in fact, worldwide. So I'm going to trust that you have, in fact, understood and heard some of the good work that Janet Schmidt and Colleen Tuck have talked about within the last year and indeed within the last weeks. In the case of Colleen, been up here to talk about stuff that they're doing locally. So I'm going to talk a little bit about border justice and what I was up to in Tucson, Arizona. At the beginning of the service, you may have received a piece of white paper with a website on it. That website is the homepage of a collaboration between the Pima County Coroner's Office and Humane Borders, a nonprofit organization, where they've undertaken the mapping of remains found in the southern desert. And the mapping that they have extends from the middle 80s all the way through present day and is continuously updated. If you'd like to go there now, I won't hold it against you. I advise you that seeing the flush of data that arises when you finally hit the go button and all those red dots come up can be shocking. And if kids get a hold of it, I invite you to really contextualize it with them, because it's underneath those dots is an individual, there's a human being, and in many cases it's a human being whose remains have gone unidentified. And even if you go back 10 years and look at those spreadsheets and look at those red dots, you'll see that many of those remains were never identified, nor cause of death. So there has been so much published about the trial of Dr. Scott Warren. Some of it, you know, good information, and some of it, it depends on what you read. But I recommend to you that you go to The Intercept, which is an online magazine, where a reporter named Ryan Devereaux has done extensive reporting. There are other outlets, for instance, of course, The New York Times, Democracy Now!, have done both radio, video, and print reporting on the trial of Scott Warren. What I'm about to read from you, or to you, is from a very long article that was published in May by Ryan Devereaux, and from a five-part article about what is happening now in the trials of Dr. Scott Warren, who, by the way, is a volunteer for No More Deaths and by career is a PhD geographer studying cultural geography. So here we are, a slow-motion disaster. Scott Warren has a checklist he goes through every time he finds a body in the desert. The earthly components are straightforward: log the GPS coordinates, take photographs and notes, scour the brush for more bones, and pull together all the data pertinent to the investigation that local authorities will, in theory, initiate once they arrive. These elements are basic evidence gathering, but for Warren, the process doesn't end there. Warren believes that these moments merit an acknowledgement of humanity, and so after years of recoveries, the 36-year-old has developed a modest ritual for the grim encounters. He goes quiet, lowers himself to the earth, collects the dirt around him, then lets the soil pour through his fingers. The point, Warren says, is to take a moment to reflect or, as he puts it, hold space. It may not sound like much, but for him, this process and everything that attends to it is as sacred as anything one might find in a conventional house of God. When a person dies, Warren believes, some extra physical element of them remains, dwelling in the place where they passed. In the last 6 years, Warren has communed with the dead no fewer than 16 times in the desert outside Ajo, the tiny Arizona border town he calls home. Those bodies and fragmented sets of human remains have served as his window into the slow-motion disaster unfolding in the borderlands, one in which U.S. government policy funnels migrants into the desert, creating a black hole of disappearance and death of historic proportions. In response, Warren has helped convene a network of Arizona humanitarian aid volunteers with roots that go back decades. Through sweat-drenched marches deep into the Sonoran Desert, this collective has expanded access to water and medical aid in one of the border's deadliest and most remote corridors, and fueled a historic increase in the number of bodies accounted for there. Even for those who can't be saved, the finding of human remains opened the door for bodies to be returned to grief-stricken families, providing answers to painful questions. In an alternate universe, one could imagine the effects of Warren and his cohort being the kind of thing a society might actively support or even prioritize, but that is not what is happening in Arizona right now. As the final hours of daylight faded on January 17, 2018, Warren stood outside a modest building cobbled together from darkened wood and gray metal sheeting on the outskirts of Ajo, about 40 miles from the border. Rusted gardening tools and sun-bleached license plates hung from its wall. At its peak was a sign constructed of four wooden planks, the barn. Largely through Warren's caretaking and initiative, the barn had evolved in recent years into a nerve center for humanitarian organizations. It was a place where men, women, and children trekking through the desert could find aid, and where young people came to learn about the violence, both real and imagined, that defines the United States' southern border. Warren scanned the horizon. He was expecting visitors, a group of high school students. A vast expanse of saguaros and creosote stretched out before him. As he turned his gaze east down a rutted dirt road, something unusual came into focus. Clouds of dust kicked up by a caravan of vehicles headed his way. Across a broad desert wash, two men looked on. Though dressed in plain clothes, the pair were agents of the U.S. Border Patrol, part of a specialized anti-smuggling unit that had been investigating the barn for months in a crackdown on the faith-based organization No More Deaths. I'll stop here to say that, in case you wonder, where No More Deaths is actually a mission of one of the Unitarian churches in Tucson and is fiscally sponsored by them. That morning, No More Deaths, also known as No Más Muertes, had published a scathing report, complete with video evidence, implicating the Border Patrol in the destruction of thousands of gallons of water left for migrants in the desert. Now it seemed the Border Patrol was punching back. Here's a photo of the barn. It looks surprisingly like a barn. The agents considered Warren a recruiter, encouraging college students to join a criminal conspiracy that involved furthering migrants' unlawful entry into the country by providing them with water and medical aid. For Warren, the timing of their arrival was not good. Inside the barn that day were two Central American men, Cristian Perez Villanueva, a citizen of El Salvador, and Jose Arnaldo Zacaria Godoy, a citizen of Honduras, who had come to the property 3 days earlier after a harrowing trek through the desert. An additional crew of Border Patrol agents and local sheriff's deputies mustered at a motel down the road before setting off. As the convoy of mostly unmarked vehicles moved in, the agents in the brush ran toward the barn. The first of the vehicles, a purple Dodge, pulled into the driveway, coming to a stop at Warren's feet, men with badges and guns piled out. Warren told them that they were stepping onto private property and requested that they leave. The agents, who did not have a warrant, persisted. With weapons drawn, they swept through the barn. The migrants were found inside, one of them hiding in a shower. Warren was handcuffed and arrested. He was accused of providing the man with food, water, clean clothes, and a place to sleep over 3 days. A month later, a grand jury indicted him on 2 counts of harboring and 1 count of conspiracy. If convicted and sentenced to consecutive terms, Warren can serve up to 20 years in prison. Here is a really lovely portrait of Scott Warren, which does little or nothing to sort of diffuse the halo with which he's been come to be endowed in the public eye. But a really lovely portrait. And one last thing I want to show you. There is much, much more to read here. It's a very, very long article. But the thing that I gave you on that little piece of paper is, like I said, it's an infographic, and you can call it pieces. What The Intercept has done, if I can find it, is consolidate the data into a graphical interface format so that the dots move down the years. Are you seeing this? If you view this material, keep in mind that these are remains that have been found. If there's no data, that doesn't mean that there are no remains. It means that, for whatever reason, remains have not been found.
Every Sunday morning, the worship coordinator, as Barbara did this morning, begins our service with the statement, "We are a welcoming congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association." But what does that mean? Per the UUA, a welcoming congregation is inclusive and expressive of the concerns of people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and/or queer at every level of congregational life, in worship, in program, in social occasions, welcoming not only their presence, but the unique gifts and particularities of their lives as well. Our church began its journey towards becoming a welcoming congregation in 2002. A welcoming committee was formed to lead the congregation over 2 years in a variety of worship services, workshops, films, and discussion groups to educate our members about LGBTQ history, life, and culture. We also practiced what it meant to be a truly inclusive congregation, beginning with building a sensitivity towards language. Our annual Rainbow Sunday, which we do every June, was created through this process. In early 2004, our church completed UUA's certification process for becoming a welcoming congregation. The timing could not have been more perfect, because the Massachusetts Supreme Court authorized marriage equality to begin that May. Massachusetts became the very first state in the United States to legalize marriages of same-sex couples. As a welcoming congregation, our church was ready to welcome same-sex couples who wished to legally marry here. Liz and I were legally married that June. And for the next several years, we were strong advocates for spreading marriage equality equally throughout the country until ultimately the United States Supreme Court made it so. Our congregation has also worked to educate ourselves on the spectrum of gender identities beyond the binary male and female and what it means to be transgender. Although there is much more for us to learn together about gender identities. Today, UUA reports that over 800 Unitarian Universalist congregations are currently approved as welcoming congregations. And UUA wishes to be bolder with our welcome. Transgender UUs are still struggling to find community at UU congregations. Bisexual UUs suffer from invisibility, while asexual, intersex, and polyamorous communities are wrestling with the progressive faith that does not truly recognize their truth. These and the many more social ills that plague our LGBTQ+ communities are calling UUAs into a deeper commitment to ensure that our UU congregations are living into the welcome that we boldly proclaim. As such, the UUA has introduced an updated annual renewal process for welcoming congregations. Our Social Justice Committee has begun leading us through this new process by coordinating with Reverend Jolie and our Worship Committee to add more welcoming topics into our worship services throughout the year, not just on Rainbow Sunday. Additionally, in January, we invite you to individually or through a group begin to participate in a program called the Transforming Hearts Collective. Through this program, we will learn together more about the spectrum of gender identities and what it truly means to be transgender or more. We will also explore how to deepen our commitment to being a welcoming congregation, a church that is welcoming to all.
So looking at the time, I think we only have a few more minutes and we won't be able to get everything in. So we were going to do a responsive reading, and that is, the responsive reading is on the back of your order of service. And it's a prayer written by Mr. Barb Grieve, who is the co-moderator of the Unitarian Universalist Association and co-founder of TRUST, which stands for Transgender, Religious, Professional, Unitarian Universalist Together. It was written as a prayer of mourning to be spoken on the Transgender Day of Remembrance, which will be this Wednesday, November 20th. I'm gonna hold off on reading it right now because we only have a few minutes. Hopefully we will have time, but I just wanted to get in a few closing words and thank all of our speakers today. We mentioned fire drill and you all, you know, moaned about that, and I think it might be happening very shortly. So I wanted to make sure, if we have a chance, we will do that, but I wanted to make sure we thanked all of our speakers today. And I wanted, you know, also to say that, as you heard from each of them, I think oftentimes when we think of social justice, we think of action, right? What can we do? What actions can we take? And of course, that is really important. And there are actions that need to be taken. Some things are very urgent and need our immediate attention. However, it's increasingly becoming clearer that something else is being called forth into social justice work. And using these words, a longing to connect social change and spiritual integrity. And I think you heard that in each of the speakers today as well, right? It's not just about action, but it's really holding some spiritual integrity, coming from our hearts, not just our minds. And that phrase, a longing to connect social change and spiritual integrity, comes from the Be the Love. It's an initiative created to support individuals and faith communities to live more deeply into beloved community. I would assume that a lot of people have heard that term, beloved community. That's a phrase from Martin Luther King that's made, you know, very well known, and it's about a vision. And it's, again, it's about definitely taking action, but also being aware of our intentional, being aware of where our hearts, how we're being when we're taking that action. Last week, Reverend Jolie asked us to pay attention and slow down. And I think that's part of the social justice work, that we have to be intentionally focused on bringing more spirituality into our meetings and our work. And that is what the Social Justice Committee members have decided that is important for us as members as well. So I just want to remind us to allow ourselves the time and space to breathe fully and deeply so that we can be still and connect to something larger than ourselves, to observe our thoughts and feelings and allow whatever's present to be present without judgment, whether it be anger, grief, despair, hope, joy, whatever is there, and it's probably going to be a mixture of both, and to sense into our hearts and hear what is calling us as individuals. We've asked you today to think about what you might be passionate about. Where does your purpose lie? Where are you being called to speak out and take action? And most importantly, let's focus on creating a beloved community. So seeing that the bell hasn't gone off yet, if you go to the back of your service, we will read that now, and me and I will take turns. We can just take turns in here. It's on the back of the order of service.
This is a prayer for the lost ones, those taken from us too soon and too many.
Truth be told, one would be too many. One life taken is one many to be dead.
This is a prayer for those whose lives were taken in violence, for who they were and how they loved.
Those who are no longer with us were people, they were our siblings and parents, our children, co-workers, and lovers.
This is a prayer for their families, who will never know all of who they were to become, nor never again feel their warm embrace. May their memories ease their grief.
This is a prayer for the lost ones, beautiful human beings who once occupied this earth with beauty, humor, anger, frustration, and fear, and who are no longer with us.
This is a prayer for those who are now our ancestors. We pray you continue to guide us towards making a more just, more loving, and more accepting world.
This is a prayer for the survivors of hate crimes and hate, for those who live in fear and cannot flourish as they are.
This is a prayer for the survivors whose lives have been impacted by violence and hate. May we remember the legacy from which we come and the legacy we will leave behind.
May we continue to build families of choice and protection for our souls as well as our bodies, trusting that we were always meant to be here and knowing that we are loved just as we are.